What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks.
In today's world, abolition is becoming a mainstream conversation. The evils of colonization are being taught in middle school. The way things have been are clearly labeled as the cause for the way things are. And people, a lot of people of all political stripes, are wondering if there's a different way, a better way, a more just way, an easier way, perhaps, for things to be done. Our guest today believes and has demonstrated through her own lived experience that there absolutely is. Our guest today is Niloufar Kansari. Nilu is a dedicated leader in collective governance with over 20 years of experience in social justice advocacy, movement lawyering, and shaping values-driven organizations. Their approach is rooted in extensive training from activists, undocumented organizers, and community leaders focused on creating more than just equitable systems. As co-founder of Pangea Legal Services, Nilo helped build a high-functioning, collaboratively run nonprofit that supported over 50,000 immigrants. There's so much more. You got to look at the book, get the book, read the bio in the back. I got to stop there, but we will discuss more of Nilo's brilliance as we go. Their book that we are discussing today is The Future is Collective, Effective Workplace Strategies for Building a Culture of Care, Frameworks and Practices for Nonprofits and Changemakers. Welcome to the show, Nilo. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Kat.
Nilo, I have a reputation for like being transparent when I talk to people, whether that's on the radio or, you know, at a meeting or, you know, just one-to-one. I just cut to the chase. And I think that's important, right? I think that particularly for people in leadership, it's really important that your humanity is front and center, right? I think we make a huge mistake often, society-wise, and then leaders ourselves, like putting ourselves on a pedestal, which separates us from the people. So I say all that to say, I am not an unbiased journalist, right? I'm a human being, yeah. And there's definitely bias. And I gotta be honest, like this was a rough interview to prepare for me, because, right, so this is one hat, right, my role at KPFA. And then there's my other hat as the leader of a nonprofit. Didn't start as a nonprofit, started as a cadre organization, but became a nonprofit. And as I was reading the book, I was like, okay, well, why is this hard? Why was this hard? And so some of it was my political belief systems. Some of it, you gave me this word in the book, my ego. Rough because I saw myself in so many of the pages. Rough, I think, though, also because in this moment where I don't know, we're 3 or 4 years post, like, you know, being in space together for the first time, I find myself standing in front of a pile of dropped Black women executive directors who started orgs, bled for orgs, tried to implement many of the principles, albeit often clumsily, I'll say for myself, right, clumsily, only to have similar principles weaponized against them by mostly non-Black people in the name of equity and collectivity. And so I was sitting with all of that as I went through the pages of the book. And so like emotions might come up. And so I just want to be honest about that now. You might make me cry. So
thank
I want to move. Yeah. I mean, like this is where we're starting from. And I saw you nodding your head, right? For those who aren't watching this on YouTube, like we know the legacy of what happens to Black women that start orgs, and it's awful.
I tried to center the voices of Black women, especially queer women, queer brown, indigenous, especially Black folks like Adrienne Marie Brown, Ella Baker, others, many others, in this work. I was nodding because I can relate. It was a hard journey, my own experience in kind of deconstructing and unpacking these systems that were part of me and part of my belief system, but also not aligned with some of my values. And then the actual practice of going through it, you know, moving from executive director title to two co-executive directors to then, you know, 21 co-directors, you know, flattening and distributing decision-making authority in a really structured way. It was, that's what was kind of coming up for me as you were speaking, Kat, because it's, that journey was one of the hardest things in my life. And you know, as a woman of color, as a person of color, a queer person, I also felt a lot of, you know, pride and achievement in like my leadership position. And unpacking that and diffusing that in a worker-led structure was it was painful a lot of the time. There were a lot of like what the f kind of moments. I'm okay saying this, but why, how come you're telling me you want this? You want to take my power away. There were, yeah, I've it was an emotional process like going through it, and then it was like emotional once again as I was writing and processing over the years. It took 4 years to come out with this book. Yeah.
You do center the voices of women of color and Black women, and as a Black woman, I thank you for that because it allowed me to hear from people that look like me, which also helped me be able to sit in the text. And then I say this a little bit later, but one of the things that I bring up and I wanted to highlight was your vulnerability throughout the book, your honesty and transparency about, one of the issues I have with our movement. Is abolitionist to sort of spit theory, like, well, this is the way it should be. And then when you ask about the nitty-gritty, right? And that's why I call myself abolitionist, like, because like, well, we don't have to talk about that right now. But no, actually we do, because my neighbor wants to know what we're gonna do with the person that just shot somebody on her front doorstep. So I understand that that's not where you want to start, but if we're gonna convince the actual masses who we say we're certain, like, we need to get into the details. And our movement, I think, is part of how we lose some things. And you were so vulnerable about the humanity of all of this and where you tripped up and where there was mistakes. And it's and especially as women of color, like, I think we're raised up to you're not allowed to make mistakes. You're not allowed to be human. You're not allowed to be vulnerable. Like, you better have it all together all the time, because otherwise you're just leaving an opening, right, for not just external enemies that serve white supremacy, but internally for there to be attacks. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, the vulnerability piece is that was a hard one. And that was one of the feedbacks I got from colleagues over my time at Pangea Legal Services. Whenever I did show up with some slight vulnerability, I got like extremely positive feedback. Like, thank you for sharing. Thank you for being vulnerable. And it was so uncomfortable and a process. And same with the book. I needed a lot of help. From others, from editors, friends, colleagues, to bring out more of my vulnerability and not be talking from like this high horse. That's my tendency. And, a lot of leaders, we were pushed into that. We have to be flawless and have it together.
There's a place in the book, one of many, where I felt like a mirror was being held up to my face, right? And I'm sure so many women of color leaders, whether you're leading an org or a movement or your household, are going to see themselves when turning their pages. And that is, see, I told you I might cry. And that is equating overworking with our personal value. I talk often about, like, I was brought up as an organizer: work, smoke, drink, die, white supremacy doesn't sleep, and you don't either, right? And that's not this is not how I'm trying to bring up, right, the organizers, that I, the younger people, we've lost so many freedom fighters to that flawed model. I said something like a dead organizer is not helpful. A permanently damaged organizer is not helpful. Can you talk about how this showed up for you and how your coworkers responded? And specifically, I'm talking about where you were mandated to go sit down somewhere. Because that happened to me too. That happened to me.
Yeah. I'm so curious what happened with you and what you learned from that. And yes, it happened. It happens to many of us. It happened to me. I was I mean, from an early age, I was like, conditioned to grind and to like perform more and do more and do sleep when I die. That was like a motto that was common for me growing up. In my household, it was a little bit of an immigrant mindset, also, we have to like prove ourselves and do more and do better than other people in our surroundings, to even like be level. That grind, yeah, I there were multiple like points. Like one was a crisis point internally in my organization and on my team, where I kind of conveyed to the team, and acted in like this very directive ways that were top down and hierarchical, and folks and told folks, you all need to do more work. You need to do, we need to distribute and have some kind of level, amount of like productivity, like feeding into the system that conditions us into productivity. And at that point, a lot, several colleagues, new colleagues who were like, oh, I joined this because I thought we were non-hierarchical, and and we have these values of shared leadership, and we're a collective, but you're being very hierarchical, Nilu. And I was like, okay, but like I'm maxed out. I have like triple the caseload. I was representing clients in detention and deportation proceedings, and doing organizing work and fundraising and doing other things, and doing policy advocacy on the local, state, and national levels. It was just a lot. And so I was pushing myself, and then I had a little bit of a similar expectation on my colleagues, and that resulted in the moment of like crisis. Even though, like, on the one hand, I was like, we have equal salaries. Like, what organization has equal salaries? We are non-hierarchical. We're putting our money where our mouth is in this instance. Like, every single person on this staff was being paid the same as myself and everyone. And I was like, yeah, and we have these, we have flexibility, and we have our values. And I was like, I should be getting a medal, an award for the way I'm leading over here. What's why you like criticizing me? I didn't hear the bottom line, the message. And the message that wasn't heard, that I wasn't hearing, was like, yes, our salaries are the same. Yes, like there are a lot of things that are better in this organization than many groups out there. And like, we still aren't really feeling like we're heard. Like, we want to be heard, and we want to be seen as staff. And even though I was thinking like, I'm doing so much, and I'm trying so hard, and my intentions are so aligned with all of our values together, there was still like, at the end of the day, this desire to feel more heard and understood and seen, and it was creating this rift. That's one, that's one area of this like the struggle. And then on a personal level, yeah, the overwork and lack of boundaries, it very similarly led to me also feeling unheard and unseen, in a lot of ways. And I noticed that later, years later, with support from a coach and like, a shift in mindset, I had a child, that was pretty transformative for me, and like, prioritization and like what these like values and conditions that I had internalized meant. It led to me actually cutting back and doing a lot less work in the organization. We had originally eight distributed hubs, which are like leadership committees in our organization. Initially, I was on five of those hubs and holding five out of eight pieces, like large, heavy decision-making pieces in the organization. By the end, by the time I transitioned out, I was on one hub, and I really cut back on a lot. And what I noticed, in moving into like deconditioning and deconstructing and doing less, it led to my colleagues actually appreciating and valuing me. Every time I did something that was like one of 100 things I would do in the past, I would hear appreciation and gratitude, and receive like acknowledgement. And there was like a part of, yeah, in a way, the boundaries had this like counterintuitive effect of people recognizing and acknowledging the work that was being done.
Brooks in conversation with Nilo Kamsari. Their book that we're discussing today is The Future's Collective Effective Workplace Strategies for Building a Culture of Care, Frameworks and Practices for Nonprofits and Changemakers. So APTP, as you probably well know, is hierarchical. It's hierarchical and it's black-led. Pretty unapologetically, or absolutely unapologetically. As I'm getting older, right, I'm learning that there's no such thing as a zero-sum game and that multiple things can be true at the same time, right? So part of what was lifted up for me in your book is like, even though the things that happened that were not great on the part of certain folks that were part of the team, that doesn't make the other pieces untrue, i.e., the overwork, i.e., not listening, right? Like all of those things can be true at the same time. And so you asked what happened to me. Well, the first, what is in relation to what you just, I don't think you said this part of the story, but problematic in part because the charge was led by a white woman in a black led organization. So that was an issue. But what was, and I was mandated to take, so I too, as you talk in the book, I'd been 14 years. And yes, I'd taken vacations, but I'd worked through every single one, right? Like there was never a time, you know, I mean, my daughter so resentful, like, couldn't even go to lunch, right? And someone would come up and I would just start talking to that person, right? Vacations, I was like, I would do go places where I could align time zones so I could still take meetings. And so I got told, it's like, you have to go away. You have to go away and you have to turn off your phone because I was bleeding all over them. Right? Like I was not a nice person. I was not a pleasant person. I was right. It was not fun working with me. And my justification was like, we fight the police for a living. People are dying. Shut up. Right? Time for that. Here's the thing though. Here's then what happened. So I did it, right? I was like, okay, you're right. This is a problem. While I was gone, with no phone and no computer and no nothing, one of the most massive mistakes, and I'm not going to call it, but one of the most massive organizational mistakes in the history of the organization that cost us millions of dollars, $1.5 million, was made.
What was it?
If I tell them, it's gonna be, but someone didn't push a button on a thing that we've been working on for a really long time.
Oh my God.
And in my head, right? So this is where I want your help. Because in my head, I was like, this is why I don't leave. This is why I don't turn off the phone. This is why I can't. And this isn't an incompetent person. Let me be really clear. This is a very competent human being. This is not, this is someone that above, you know, exceeded expectations above and beyond. Like it was, but then I, so then I have all this guilt, right? Because as like I'm responsible, it was awful. And it has made, I'm not gonna lie, it has made the journey to try to continue in that vein and set boundaries and take time, which I've gotten better at because I cracked. I had to hit it on the way bottom. After that, because I was like, when I came back, I was like, yeah, well, you just proved me right. I'm gonna kill myself with work to make sure it never happens again. So it's been a rough, right? So all of those things happen inside of this dynamic. So I just your reflections on that and like, what would you tell a leader that you're coaching, right, to try to get to this place of shared leadership that has these kinds of experiences and is like, I don't know what to do.
Yeah. I mean, the main question that comes up for me is like, what are our accountability systems? Because that's like, I mean, we need that. That is the number one thing that we have in collectively led organizations when we do, and places where we do honor a leader stepping back and leadership being shared and folks taking on responsibilities, more responsibilities, that, you know, responsibilities and more authority in an organization by multiple people comes with a rigorous, or needs to come with a very rigorous accountability process, both on like a, you know, day to day, even from day one. And this is one of the things I cover in the book. You know, a lot of worker cooperatives, this and nonprofit organizations that are led but in cooperative, collective ways, have an onboarding period that lasts 9 to 12 months or 6 to 12 months. And that on period onboarding period, you know, people they often call it candidacy periods, not probation to, you know, to take away from this criminal legal system or the criminal legal language, and instead candidacy to reflect the way that people are honored during that time, which is like full pay, full benefits, and extreme, like high levels of support and resourcing. But at any point in the 9 to 12 months onboarding, there is high levels of accountability, and you're not hired until you're fully hired on and voted on as a full member at the end of that period. And there are, checkpoints every 3 to 6 months, 3 months, 6 months. And that's one of the policies that we implemented at my former organization that worked well. And it also resulted in being able to let folks go in a humane way. So that's one accountability beginning. And then there are, accountability forms in the throughout feedback systems, supervision or circular supervision, check-ins. There's structure, and there, in the book, I have over 50 pages of appendices and samples that folks can use and reflect, and modify for their own tools. And some of the things that I'm sharing here are in that. There are checkpoints, and there are feedback systems and forms of accountability that can be held for organizations of any size. And those same examples that I speak of and share are organizations from 2 to over 3,000 people. And kind of the magic number of self-governing teams is 10 to 12. So, when I say collective and we make decisions in a collective, we don't have, 100 people voting on every tiny decision. Ideally, there are 10 to 12 people involved giving feedback and input, and not everyone is making the decision and giving a vote on everything. But there's, coming back to the accountability, there's accountability at the, after the onboarding period, after the candidacy period, through regular check-ins and feedback mechanisms and tools. And then there's also a clear and structured process for letting folks go. A colleague of mine, another consultant, Tamala Gresham, a really brilliant person, she says that organizations, we struggle with a lot of, especially folks who are not management and but want to have more say and want to have more power in organizations, have a really hard time letting people go and with letting people go. And Tamala says, we're not, nonprofits are not in the business of employing people, unless you're an employment-based organization where you like support employment, placing people in employment. Our missions are different, and we need to focus on that. And unless our mission is to employ people, everyone on this planet, then we need to have some clear guidelines on when we let people go. And there are samples in the book about this too, and a system and process. So accountability, there's accountability for the duration of people's like period, like time at an organization, and a $1.5 million mistake. I mean that. That's to me, I would say, okay, like, does it meet the threshold of letting this person go? Or do you want, like, is that something that you're gonna work with and like, create a learning process around and give somebody, some time to course correct around? Mistakes happen, and sometimes they're very expensive. And and we all know justice is expensive. Justice is very expensive. And so to lead in a just way and in caring ways is often, can be expensive, and learning mistakes are also expensive.
Thank you for that, Nilu. Yeah, I mean, I'll just, I mean, you were vulnerable, but like, so several of the mistakes that I made over the, liberalism kills. And we say that in movement, right? Like, and I said it all the time, all the time, all the time, all the time. And then I spent 2 years being incredibly liberal. And I don't mean, for people who don't know what that means, please Google it. I don't mean politically. I mean in terms of accountability, because you're right. Like, we have massive hearts, right? And then, but the price that the organ, forget me, I mean, there was a personal cost all over Instagram, but the cost of the organization, the cost of the rest of the team who I'm responsible for and to, right? That was the biggest kick in the teeth. I mean, what did my daddy say? Hard head makes for a sore backside. And so I knew all this stuff, and I did it the other way anyway.
But you don't throw out the I mean, there's so many ways that I hear this in the context of like collectivism or non-hierarchy versus hierarchy. And I, you know, hierarchical organizations, I believe there can, like, I really believe, and I've seen many organizations that are, you know, structured and with some levels of hierarchy. And even the collectively led organization I was a part of and co-created was hierarchical when it was distributed. There were hierarchies, there were decision makers, there were clear like leadership responsibilities and people with authority. I'm not advocating for, you know, cutting off the heads of like any kind of hierarchy.
Yeah, what I was saying was, and not just necessarily in that situation, right, but across the board that I engaged in liberalism. So there wasn't accountability, right?
Oh.
Which then led to, actually, I'll take it one further and open up sort of space for you. There wasn't accountability, which sort of led to a free for all. And then it wasn't until things got so bad that I was like, I have to rein this in. But then, of course, people are bucking. You know, so it's the cost to the org, to the team, to the folks on staff that were handling it. Like, it was just like if I had just engaged in rigorous communication, if I had just engaged in structured accountability practice, if I had just not been liberal, if I had just, because even that's ego, right? Not wanting people to be mad at you, that's ego too,
Oh
right?
yeah.
So I allowed my ego to get in the way.
Yeah, and it hurts. I mean, it hurts. There's a legitimate, like, we're human and we're feeling. I think you spoke to this, Kat, in the beginning. You know, people often look at us as leaders, as people who are like machines who do it all, and we don't have feelings, and it hurts. It just deeply hurts when there's like a broken trust or you know, disbelief in something that, you know, or a break in you know, yeah, in anything. And so that's there. In terms of there's something else that's coming to mind as you're speaking. Like, there's this if I had just been like less liberal, if I'd just done something different, there's two parts. You know, there's like leadership, our part, like our role, and the accountability we take. And I think we're often really good and really quick to take accountability and responsibility for our actions. And you know, I'm hearing you say that with, you know, the vacation or the break that you took, and cut out, you know, did listen to your team, and then you took accountability for the mistakes that took place while you were not there. And then there's like the accountability that the team also, you know, others need to take. And the what I experienced early on at Pangea was people were, you know, I was feeding into this, you know, in a way, but there were two parts. I was being a leader who was directive and, you know, moving things forward, and my colleagues who were supposed co-leaders in this with me were actually not acting and taking on the full role as co-leaders. They were often asking for permission, and kind of asking for, you know, asking for a ask turning to me as a superior rather than an equal and a partner, a thought partner and thought leader in the work. And so that shift and that transition, I think, is the part that the step that gets missed in a lot of spaces, a lot of liberal spaces, a lot of leftist groups. You know, you and everybody's anti-authority, and everybody gets ex there's this like canceling. Yeah, everybody's like canceling is like, no, like we don't want it because any kind of authority is bad. Power and authority is not bad. It's not inherently bad. And it's the way that we hold it, it's the way that we share it and are in power with folks that matters. And there's a requirement in the there's a need for folks with less perceived or actual authority to also step in and move into that power and authority in a way that demonstrates, like, you know, that shared with it takes two. It takes both. It's not one way. It can't ever be one way. So the thing that I've noticed with a lot of organizations is, you know, that when there's this like anti-power thing, they just cut off the person at the top. And it's especially problematic when it's a woman, a person of color, a black woman especially. Like it's very problematic, like you're saying, you know, and it's and the people that are naming it and most vocal often are with like, you know, more privileged identities. Makes sense. But then you have this vacuum and you don't often you usually we don't have a structure and like a the way forward and how. And a lot of times what I see is things turn antagonistic. It turns into like a an us versus them, and we replicate the external systems that we have, you know, like the corporate structures. It's like, you know, us against them, the, you know, the people with power or perceived power that are pretending like they don't. Or it turns into like, you know, nothing gets done or conversations take forever, and that is not what we advocate for. And one of the things that that I share in the book is examples from many organizations. Like there are dozens that I dozens of people that I worked with that have moved and shifted into this like more collective space with, you know, with really high functioning effective results. And the key to that is we need a structure for this culture of shared power and caregiving. And that structure can look a lot of different ways. There are as many structures as there are organizations and groups of people in this world. And I have examples internationally, I have a lot of examples nationally, and groups that have like it brings me really back to the accountability piece. Groups that have structure also have a lot of accountability and support or to uphold that structure and to support each other. And one of the things that at Pangea we had was in our committees, the structures that we had, the subcommittees that we called hubs, we had at least one person that had a lot of like institutional knowledge or expertise on the topic. Like whether it was the budget, whether it was, you know, HR, whether it was another major area of the organization, decision area of the organization, fundraising, whatever it was, high expertise, at least one. And then we would always also have at least one person who was newer to the work. And then there were, you know, maybe one or two or three other additional folks. And so the intention was to create redundancy and duplicity in the expertise of the work. And there's a sustainability piece to that for when I finally left or like, you know, took leaves. There was a strong continuity in insight and knowledge in the organization. And one of the things that I think that worked really well, especially with the fundraising piece at Pangea, was that after I left, a year later, the organization secured a $2 million unrestricted yield giving grant. And this was the income, the fundraising team, the resource mobilization team that you know, where I had been transferring knowledge and I was still the main holder of a lot of the relationships and the work. But because we had this shared structure and had cultivated for years, at the point that I left, there was continuity and there was some strength and decision making that was made that was effective in that. There's something else that you brought up. Oh, you know, on the very expensive mistake, there was a. I don't, this is a little risky. I don't know how much I can I want to share or reveal, but I feel free to cut this.
You can say you relate. I
What's that?
say you can just say you relate. I don't want to get you in trouble.
I was late. Oh,
No, relate,
oh,
relate.
I can relate.
Yeah.
Oh, I can, you know, I can relate to the very expensive mistake. You know, there was some delegations that I supported and that I didn't, that I kind of really withdrew and like was hands off on. That also led to very, very expensive outcomes for my organization at the time. Oh, I don't know. I don't want to cut. I don't know if I should put this because I'm no longer there. I think if I was there, I was would be more confident. And that employee is also no longer there. So cut that, please.
Okay, we will cut that. We will cut that. Yeah, I thought about even like
But
whether it was
yeah, we had an $800,000 mistake. I get it.
it's rough. So I want to get into this current moment, but I want to say one more thing first. After I say, you were listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Nilo Kansari about their new book, The Future is Collective: Effective Workplace Strategies for Building a Culture of Care, Frameworks and Practices for Nonprofits and Changemakers. While I'm reading the book and getting ready for this interview, I found myself just a couple days back from vacation, where I did, I for the most for 98%, I checked completely out. And I came back and I was like, what happened? And this and the team listening will go, yeah, that was the look on her face and that was the tone on her voice. But as I was reading your book, and I don't know which chapter this is, this what I'm about to bring up is in, but what ran through my head, I said, okay, Kat, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. I'm like, if this is the place that you keep landing, what is your role in this, or what do you keep repeating that allows these things to varying degrees, right? It's not all $1.5 million, so and I saw that I started looking for, so, right, because the book, y'all, is full of solutions, right? Like this is how you move forward, and I got so excited on the co-creating expectations piece. I'm going to do that with the team. Talk a bit about why that is so important and what potentially harmful patterns co-creating expectations can interrupt.
I love that you're asking this. I'm curious what you're gonna do with the team, or what part you're is resonating right now, in the co-creating expectations part.
I'm gonna call you after this. We're gonna talk about it.
Okay. The yeah, co-creating expectations. I think that the one of the things that I learned the hard way was when a lot of people had different ideas, or we all thought we had an idea. For example, we were hiring someone to fill a certain role. It was a new position and a new role. I can compare this to one other time we co-created, we created a new role. So one time we created a new position, a new role, and we thought we had a shared idea of what this person was going to be doing and who they were going to be working with. And then they started, and they didn't really deliver on the things that some of us expected them to do. And others had different expectations and ideas. And none of this was detailed or written down and anticipated in a detailed way. And it was hard to do that because it was a new role. The person floundered, and it wasn't an effective hire a new role. The next time we were looking to hire and create a new role at a new position, we learned from that challenge that we really needed to define like what it is that this person was going to do. So a couple of us wrote out an initial job description, but not only just the job description, but also, also really specifying the percentage of time they would spend on which aspects of their work. So we had a little bit more clarity. That was that. Then we shared this with the team, and the team had this like whole reaction of, and at the time we had a practice of, everyone gives input on a new hire on like a new role, and a big significant unbudgeted expense that's ongoing like this. So there were several people on the team that were quite vocal and did not support this new position. And they raised questions. And instead of like moving along with the majority and ignoring that, we decided to slow down the process. And that was one of the learnings, that the hard learnings I've made over time. Slowing down in the short term can often result in efficiency in the long term, because people are more bought in when you slow down and when you give it the time to process. Because people don't check out when they're bought in, because it creates less like tension and like gossip and dissatisfaction down the line. Because it leads to just more retention and focus on the mission and the work when we slow it down. So we slowed down this process that I thought could be done in a few weeks. It took us like 3 months. And it was the most effective result and the most effective, like strongest thing that we co-created. So what was the expectation? Okay, we co-created this expectation around this new hire and this new position by inviting and having one-on-one conversations with the staff that were the most vocal and just did not agree with the position. That gave us information and led us to create a Q&A that we drafted and we shared and we openly discussed. You know, are there any other concerns and about this new position? You know, here's the Q&A. Here's what we heard from you. Here's what here are our answers. It led us to get more specific in some of the job description. Led us to be more realistic, because those conversations with the dissenting staff led us to actually measure out the hours that we would expect the new staff to take on. And the new role in this instance was a bird's eye view coordinator, somebody who would coordinate between the hubs and the organization and hold and connect and be sort of a glue and also a people care person. We had not had a formal role like this before. It had been informally held by the former co-EDs. And then there had been a gap in that role. So it took some convincing for the staff to recognize the value of this invisible work. So it made us visibilize it more, and put hours to each of the tasks per week, per month, and a total per year. And we realized, oh my gosh, this is like actually the job of a person and a half. And because of the questioning and the poking at and the doubts of this role, we got even more specific and cut back and realistic and got realistic about what's priority, what would be the second priority, and what would be the third priority in the amounts of work and different workflows. So in the end, the co-creation of the expectations of what this new hire would do became this really great model and sample for like a thoughtful, collaborative process that folks were actually bought in on. Even those that weren't like fully bought in, they didn't object and they didn't, have a concern, and over time recognized more, a little bit more, the value of that role. And so it created a, like I think you were coming back to the accountability piece. It created a thing that we could all be accountable to and hold the new role or the new project accountable to, but also ourselves.
God bless you, because I ain't gonna lie. Like that, moments like that. Sometimes I'm like, yeah, let's do this. And sometimes I'm like, don't have time. I don't have time. I don't have time. I don't have time. They're killing three of us a day. I gotta move. And I'm not completely opposed to that, and I've paid the consequences for that, right? So it's both. And I only have a couple of minutes left with you, but I don't want to close without this. You say in the book, like I'm so passionate about where the bleep are our organizers right now, that when people spit organizer stuff, I get really excited. That makes sense. I get really excited. You say in the book, quote, "Organizers know well that the biggest moments of crisis are also the biggest moments for opportunity to mobilize, politicize, engage, act, and grow. The key is preparation and planning for such moments because they are cyclical," end quote. My refrain in these very difficult and scary times is telling people, like, look for the opportunities in this moment and organize inside of that, right? For long-term change, the material conditions for our folks. Because when we, not if, when we get to the other side, the only way that we can say that we've won is if the conditions have changed. Like, we cannot go through with the bloodbath that is just going to get more bloody. as this goes on, and end up on the other side with less. Like that's what can happen, right? And I think this is actually the biggest opportunity we've had to change the trajectory of this country since the Civil War. That's my analysis. So I want to close our time together with your couple of minutes, advice for leaders, organizers, organizations. How do we hold on to our values, our humanity, our principles in moments of crisis like this, which also present the largest opportunity for us to lose all of those things in the name of doing the work?
That is such a big question, Kat. Well, I mean, I would start with organizers. Organizers, like we know that the law was not made for us. Like we didn't need this administration, or we don't need constant crises to know the law is not made for us, and the systems are not set up for us. And I knew that well as an immigration attorney, as an immigrant rights advocate at Pangea. And the way that we organized and used opportunities in moments of crisis under the first Trump administration, we went beyond the law. We had to go beyond the law. The law wasn't going to be protecting us because we would have people detained and mandatory detention and deportations, and like there was nothing structurally set up for us in some of our cases. And I learned from organizers, from other organizers. I was, it was early in my career, one of the first detained cases, the second detained case I ever had, that extra legal means are going to be what gets us what we need, the freedom and the justice that eventually comes. And it was the organizers that showed me that, like, when we're values driven and not the lawyer, I had this one case. Every lawyer, I was young, I was asking for advice from senior attorneys, and every single one was like, "Oh, it's a black letter law. Like, they're mandatory detention. He's going to be detained. He's going to be deported. And best you can do is slow it down." And yes, like I slowed it down, but then when I talked to organizers, they were values and heart driven, and they were like, not. It's not if we're gonna get him out, it's when we're gonna get him out. And we got him out. We got him out after 3 months. And with the organizing tactics and the non-legal ways that we moved forward in that case. And I cases are a lot harder, the work is a lot harder, and there's a lot more, crisis and intensity in this moment. And I know that as organizers and activists in this field, in any field, we know we have to go beyond. And some of these crisis moments and the urgency of the moment, we have the ears and the dollars of many people that are listening and paying attention in this time. There are opportunities here. And I really appreciate what you're saying. Like, how do we move forward with the values and like living the way that we're doing the work on a day to day? My hope is, and my vision with this book is that that we start doing the internal work the same way we do externally, the collaborative, collective way, the values and heart-driven way that we move. We bring that into our workplaces. We bring in these structures, and we become really good and expert at at co-leading, at sharing and sharing power with each other on a local level, on a small level, so that we're and consistently showing up over time, organizing ourselves inside, so that when the time comes, as folks transition and move on to other places and join the political, office or local office, statewide office, and bring in these values and structures into government systems, so that the ultimate revolution is supported by this evolution that we've been practicing on a daily basis for the next, for a while.
I think you say that the revolution is the evolution. Is that in the book? Am I making that up? No, it is in the
Yes.
book. Yes, the revolution
Yes,
is the evolution is in the book. The
it
book that we're talking about is The Future is Collective: Effective Workplace Strategies for Building a Culture of Care, Frameworks and Practices for Nonprofit Change Makers, written by Niloufar Kansari. Nilou is a dedicated leader in collective governance with over 20 years of experience in social justice advocacy, movement lawyering, and shaping values-driven organizations. Their approach is rooted in extensive training from activists, undocumented organizers, and community leaders focused on creating more than just equitable systems. As co-founder of Pangea Legal Services, Nilo helped build a high-functioning, collaboratively run nonprofit that supported over 50,000 immigrants. Nilo, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Kat.
You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.